My name is Michael McCusker. If I sound like I have a bit of a cold, I do. Every time something hits me like this, I wonder what's coming down from Hanford, or perhaps even Trojan. These are, you might say, our snakes in paradise. Well, today is, pardon me, the last day of June for this year. And up comes the 4th of July weekend. The 4th being on Monday. I believe it was last year we celebrated the 4th on the 3rd, being that it was a Monday. These 3-day holidays we have put our calendars around. So I'd like to read what I generally do read on the 4th of July, my usual Independence Day rant. And I will say these two pieces that I'm going to read, I wrote, so therefore I should give the disclaimer, these are my opinions and perhaps my opinions only in the entire cosmos and multiple universes. Sons of Liberty. 235 years ago, on July 2nd, 1776, a small group of terrorists betrayed their country and voted to commit any and all acts of terror and treason which they claimed would be necessary to separate from their government. 2 days later, on July 4th, they publicly declared their intention of betrayal and categorically stated their reasons for turning against their country and threatened to murder or otherwise terrorize all who did not join with them. They began their terrorist acts several years earlier. They burned, looted, tortured, murdered, kidnapped, and held hostage representatives and supporters of their government. They ambushed and killed soldiers and policemen. Several attempts at negotiations only increased their demands and brutality until finally, the previous year, in April 1775, they committed open rebellion by attacking government forces that had been sent to protect loyal citizens from their terrorism. The terrorists cloaked their atrocities and treachery with a specious document that claimed the sanction of God and the sympathy of humanity. They named their perfidious document a Declaration of Independence. And to continue that theme, something else I wrote, Flags Passing By. Whenever an American flag is unfurled, I feel that I am a stranger instead of a citizen. I don't dislike the flag, I just feel that flag wavers and I live in separate countries. Flags are everywhere, in public places, of course. But they bloom also from houses, offices, automobiles, stenciled on T-shirts, and worn as lapel pins. These persistent and nagging proclamations of Americanhood, which might appear reasonable, though rude, in a foreign country, seem discriminatory and shabbily neurotic here at home. I am sure that most people who feel a compulsion to mark themselves with a flag believe in freedom and democracy for themselves and those they regard as like themselves, but I doubt they feel the same passion about the rights and liberties of others who practice a different religion, or none, or who have a different skin color, or are recent immigrants. The flag conceals more than it illuminates. Its red stripes represent the blood shed by the early patriots who, if anyone needs to be reminded, were traitors. The stars are symbols of conquest, the brutal displacement of one civilization by another. Some citizens veil themselves with flags, merging self-perceived inadequacies with the civic inequities and empirical ambitions disguised by fervent nationalism. Underneath the patriotic bunting can be sensed the grim frenzy and unforgiving intolerance for new ideas and those who engage in them. the pledge of allegiance to the flag that children must say every day in public schools, which contains the phrase, "One Nation Under God," is the national school prayer. A flag is, after all, a tribal totem, relatively unsophisticated in an expanding global civilization in which such iconoclastic relics of humanity's immaturity should only be displayed in museums. Yet people still do get upset when someone trods upon a flag or blows a nose on its stars and stripes. Making shirts of flags or burning them in public protest gives police and some military veterans, not all, apoplexy. Patriots, poor, confused souls who think their personal lives would improve if the United States dominated the earth, roar with anger and anguish because desecrating the flag is protected by the Constitution's guarantee of free speech and is in character with the precepts of democracy. A piece of cloth, whatever its mythological imperative, is not to be placed above human rights. What is freedom worth if in dissent against its loss, its symbols cannot be dramatically abused? Symbols are powerful. They define purpose, hold people together, but separate them also. Humanity is crossbreeding at an incredible rate. Primitive icons of separateness are increasingly meaningless. Our species will truly be free when it is able to abandon the symbols that perpetuate its divisions. The many tribes no longer need their special banners and bunting, except as family talismans put away from memory. I do not participate in flag ceremonies or attend parades in which legions of flags are marched past me. For a few years, I was obliged to salute the flag twice a day during its raising and lowering. And when I was at war for the flag, I dreaded it would swaddle my corpse. I would not spit on the flag because I don't think a flag is that important. Why should anyone care if someone burns a flag or makes love on one? And that is something I wrote. Actually, I first wrote it back in 1987, and I haven't changed my mind about it since. Well, last week I was reading from Matt Love's Grasping Wastrels and Beaches Forever Incorporated, and it was an article he had written for Hipfish on following Highway 101 and comparing it to the old WPA American Guide to Oregon, which was printed in 1940. And I got as far as Newport. So I'd like to continue on, see if I can get down to get down to Brookings. And he talks about Tour 3, which is Tour, T-O-U-R, Tour 3. Which is the Oregon coast. And Section B of Tour 3 begins south of Newport. The guide describes Waldport, which is where my sister lives, as a place where its inhabitants still make a living by clam and crab fishing and packing, though summer visitors are an increasingly important source of income. It is hard to imagine today how any Waldport resident makes a living from the ocean, but those summer visitors did increase. Just look to the vacation homes crammed together on the sand of Alsea Spit. They weren't there in 1940 when the guidebook was published. They weren't even there when Ken Kesey wrote about this wild, wet place in Sometimes a Great Notion in the early 1960s. And because this is this July 4th weekend, it's going to be crowded down there and in the southern part of the coast. And my sister and I just made a drive down there to California and back about a month ago. Lane County. Entering Lane County just past Yahats, I call it Yachits, the guide describes how Highway 101 parallels the beach and relates a story about a crafty hobo who made a perfect three-part weld at a blacksmith shop, stunning the locals. The brief narrative also employs the term tramp to define what we would now call a homeless person. During the Depression, there must have been many hobos and tramps with bindles hitchhiking Highway 101, looking or not looking for work. Homeless men still hitchhike Highway 101. No bindles in this affluent era. Backpacks now. Of course, this is not affluent anymore. Matt wrote this in 2003, before everything crashed. Many things have changed near Highway 101 in over half a century since the guide waxed so wonderfully about the Oregon coast. But one of the constants is the Sea Lion Caves, an attraction the guide explains in a sexy and enthusiastic summary. The tourists loved the sea lions and the seals in the era of the American Guide, circa 1940. But many coastal locals and Oregon fish and game officials loathed them, claiming the pinnipeds ate too many salmon. So the fishermen shot them with impunity. The state sponsored a bounty program, and pinnipeds off the Oregon coast nearly went the way of old-growth trees, wiped out. Only the 1972 Marine Mammal Protection Act, MMPA, signed by President Richard Nixon, which made it a federal crime to kill pinnipeds, saved seals and sea lions from extirpation in West Coast coastal waters. Now that the seal and sea lion numbers have dramatically rebounded, angry talk that they eat too many salmon, hatchery bred this time around, has returned. A few folks walk their talk, and every year a few Oregon coast pinnipeds have their heads blown off with total impunity because the MMPA is barely enforced. Currently, Congress is being lobbied hard to amend the law to allow fishermen to shoot nuisance pinnipeds. And that was 03, but it continues. And wolves, too, if you remember recent controversies. Continuing south from the Sea Lion Caves, the journey comes to Florence. In this section of the guide, it barely mentions the miles of sand dunes that today comprise the Oregon Dunes National Recreation Area and are home to a lively, loud, off-road vehicle scene that certainly would have appalled the guide's riders. They valued the state's beauty on a simple visceral level and would never have conceived that just being in Oregon's unique natural spaces wasn't satisfying enough. They didn't need toys. Back in the 1950s, U.S. Senator Richard Neuberger tried to persuade the National Park Service to declare the dunes around Florence a national seashore park. A few locals raised considerable opposition, came together to incorporate a town called Dunes City, and successfully thwarted the designation. Locals stopped the park idea then, but in 1972 the dunes became a national recreation area, which allows for considerably more development, off-road vehicles, and hot dog stands. Into Gardiner, the tour continues. The guide reports why most of the structures in town were white, apparently the obsession of a young manager of the lumber mill. Today the buildings aren't all white. The sprawling, rusted timber mill looks deserted. The mill manager is gone. Other humans with a very different obsession have replaced him. In 2000, a New Age nonprofit religious corporation called Living Love Fellowship relocated to Gardiner and moved into the former headquarters of International Paper. They refer to themselves as Amadonians. In addition to selling liquor license consulting services, they believe extraterrestrials and following the teachings from a Bible written by space aliens. Douglas County. Crossing the Umpqua River near an island where Native Americans ambushed a party headed by Jedediah Smith, killed 18 men, and made off with $20,000 in pelts, Highway 101 rolls into Reedsport. Today the island is an abandoned industrial site and literally rusts while waiting on the market for redevelopment. It seems Reedsport has a history of civic blight because the guide provides the town with the most unflattering description of any place on the Oregon coast. Quote, much of Reedsport was filled in from earth cut from the sandy clay banks of the hills behind the town. Most of the population lives in the dozen or so two-story rooming houses and hotels and is composed of transient laborers. South of Reedsport, Highway 101 climbs through denuded hills where stumps and blackened snags are evidence of the death of the local lumber industry. Unquote. And that's the 1940 guide. New clear cuts in exactly the same area are visible today. Coos County. The route crosses over the narrow arched Coos Bay Bridge into North Bend and serious timber country, or what used to be serious timber country. Although the nearby hills above Coos Bay are clear cut in the usual steep slope rapine manner, all the big trees are gone, and now many log trucks rattling down Highway 101 carry pecker poles, quote unquote. Marshfield, now called Coos Bay, is near the top of the crooked arm of Coos Bay, which is usually crowded with schooners being loaded with lumber cut in forests of the Coast Range, the guide reports. This place used to thrive in the miles of docks along Coos Bay, surely bustled. Today they're forlorn, deserted, and seemingly ready for a Superfund listing. Perhaps the one piece of good news about the docks came a few years ago when the Coquille tribe built a casino there, called it The Mill, and named the lounge the Hook Tender Saloon. Leaving Coos Bay, the tour heads southeast toward Coquiville and then west to Bandon to reconnect with the shore. Today, this route is State Highway 42. In the late 1950s, when the highway straighteners wanted to route Highway 101 directly to Bandon, bypassing Coquille, the locals raised hell. As in most cases, the Highway Commission won and everyone else lost, except for those who didn't mind if the state cut trees, drained wetlands, and paved more land so tourists could shave a few minutes off a trip and bypass a working-class town. Crossing the Coquille River into Bandon on the contemporary Highway 101 route provides beautiful views of the estuary and ocean. But below the bridge, the river reveals the cost of development and material progress. Much of the Coquille Basin's water is either too hot for fish, too full of bacteria, or has elevated dissolved oxygen levels. About 1940s, Coquille, the guide boasts, within the city limits, it is possible to fish for several varieties of salmon, steelhead, and trout. By 2003, some of these species have vanished from many coastal tributaries, and local subsidized farmers quote anti-private property passages from the Communist Manifesto at public meetings and say they are living under a totalitarian regime because the state wants them to quit polluting public watercourses. The guide describes Bandon as a resort with a beach at the mouth of the Coquille River and claims it was known as the most beautiful town in southern Oregon until a forest fire blew in from the east and wiped it out. Bandon was under reconstruction when the WPA, the Works Progress, WPA, writer visited. Works Progress Administration, thank you, that was the word I was looking for, writer visited. Today, it is a smart-looking city with a reputation for somewhat pretentious attitudes, some boosters now called it Bandon by the Sea, and the site of a newly constructed Lynx golf course where the affluent jet in from all over the country to play. This venture has proved so successful that other coastal areas' politicians and Babbitts, desperate to create more tourist opportunities for rich people, have showcased Bandon Dunes Golf Course as the best new way to exploit the landscape near the ocean. According to the guide, Bandon was named after the hometown of an Irish peer who settled there and imported Irish firs, a plant, quote, that in early spring yellows the sandhills along the highway southward, a thorny shrub, its pea-like flowers have an odor similar to that of coconut oil. Firs, or gorse, as it is better known, has now become an ecological vandal to the point that vacant lots are considered more valuable if they are gorse-free. Presently, gorse is confined to the southern Oregon coast. It is slowly invading north up Highway 101. And man, pardon me, but this year, 2011, gorse and Scottish broom just fill those lower Oregon towns. That's all you can see, almost. Back to Matt. Today, a few miles south of Bandon, there's another example of exotic species tainting the landscape. It's called West Coast Game Park, and this attraction features 21 acres of confined animals, including leopards, black panthers, and tigers. South of Bandon to the California border is obviously different than circa 1940, but this most inaccessible part of the Oregon coast most resembles what the WPA writers saw. They wrote little about this stretch, perhaps hoping people would ignore it. Curry County. The guide calls Curry County the most primitive county in Oregon and long isolated by lack of roads. Only around 1,000 people lived in the county in 1940, according to the guide's numbers. It's still tough to reach, and there's considerably less development here than anywhere else near Highway 101. In the 1960s, the straighteners came through anyway and literally paved the way for the last great surge of county commission-approved rapine on the Oregon coast. It hasn't happened yet. Just north of Port Orford, the tour passes through Sixes, on the banks of a small river of the same name noted for its steelhead, an anadromous fish species that spawns in small tributaries high up in the watersheds and is disappearing on the southern Oregon coast. West of Highway 101 is Cape Blanco, named by Spanish mariners in 1603 and allegedly the first spot in Oregon seen, claimed by Europeans. Over 350 years later, in 1971, it became a state park with overnight camping amenities, a development that didn't occur again on the Oregon coast until Wayland Island in Tillamook County was established in 2000. Into Port Orford, famous for its type of cedar, where the guide maintains Jack London once briefly stayed and was reputed to have written part of the Valley of the Moon. South of Port Orford, the mountains press close to the sea and the highway curves along a shelf high above the waves, the guide reports. Finally, at the summit, the route briefly leveled and then steeply descended to the mouth of a canyon. It has been said by many who traveled it that this part of the tour was the most spectacular, slow, turning, tight, bending, windswept, unique, thrilling, rugged and gorgeous stretch of the entire old Oregon Coast Highway. It took time, patience, and skill to drive, but it rewarded. This slow way is gone, now part of a 3-mile hiking trail in Humbug Mountain State Park. Realignment in the 1960s straightened the highway, brought it down from the hills, practically on the beach, along a creek, and today its widened lanes speed the motorist along. At the top of the trail, there's a picnic table on the exact spot that must have been the most dreaded hairpin turn on the entire old Oregon Coast Highway. A visitor can eat lunch here, look 1,000 feet down to the new stretch of Highway 101, see vehicles hurtling by in a blur, then turn around to take in the 2-lane wonder of the old route, now nearly overcome with brush. About 30 miles south of Port Orford is where the Rogue River enters the Pacific and Gold Beach greets visitors. The Rogue is famous for steelhead and salmon fishing, the guide boasts. The river still has that reputation, although hatchery releases here and in practically every basin on the Oregon coast were and are necessary to keep the sports fishing industry alive and deflect concerns that wild fish numbers are a fraction of what they used to be in every coastal basin. As for the town of Gold Beach, according to the guide, a saloon in the town once doubled as the county's courthouse and gold was passed freely across the counter, quote unquote. It's not that exciting today, but there's big money in trophy homes to be made in this area. Recently, though, someone monkey-wrenched part of the impending development in the Gold Beach vicinity by selling 258 acres of scenic property at Cape Sebastian to the state, which plans to roll the land into the existing Cape Sebastian State Park. Heading south to the California border, and the guide offers only a few paragraphs about the history of the area, a massacre of Indians by vigilantes at the mouth of the Pistol River, and nothing about contrived tourist attractions. There weren't such contrivances on this stretch of the Oregon coast during the Depression. There were only gorgeous natural features. During the American Guide heyday, near the Pistol River, Highway 101 used to head away from the beach, leisurely into the mountains to Carpenterville. 20 miles later, a driver ended up in Brookings. The guide describes the summit near Carpenterville as the highest point of the highway, elevation 1,715 feet. On clear days, a visitor can find Mount Shasta to the southeast. Scanning west is to take in the Pacific Ocean as far as weather permits. 60 years ago, now 70 years ago, looking down from Carpenterville towards the beach, there was no river of highway. This is the finest view on the Oregon coast. Truly awesome. One can envision the guide's rider getting out of his car, marveling, taking notes, smoking a cigarette, anxious to begin pounding a typewriter to describe this unique Oregon and American scene. To recreate this experience from 70 years ago, a traveler must take the old Highway 101 route through Carpenterville. It takes 45 extra minutes. The Carpenterville road is narrow, winding, bumpy, switchbacked, vertigo-inducing, tree-canopied, and deer-choked. Rusted old Highway 101 guardrails still protect. In places, heading south, a driver can catch glimpses of the ocean and the relocated Highway 101. In 1962, the road improvers prevailed again and pulled the route down from the hills. As a town, Carpenterville soon went away. It is still on some maps. The new Highway 101 parallels the beach and bisects a pristine state park named for Samuel Boardman, with acres and acres of asphalt. The way to Brookings is straight and fast. Finally, Tour 3 concludes with a brief reference to Brookings. Grew up around a sawmill, and a mention that Crescent City, California, is 21 miles from the border. The trip is over. Now, read the multi-part question below, posed by the guide's authors in the introduction. Will the sons of the impending industrial age be shorter and shrewder, and the daughters dependent for their beauty upon commodities sold in drugstores? And will Oregonians become less appreciative of nature and rooted living, and more avid and neurotic in the pursuit of wealth? I have driven 2 or 3A 4 times now. I know the answers. Consider what William Blake wrote in Proverbs of Hell about a century before the automobile was invented. Improvement makes straight roads, but the crooked roads without improvement are roads of genius. And that was the second part of Matt Love's article, The Straightening, which he wrote first for Hip Fish and republished in his book, Grasping Wastrels and Beaches Forever Incorporated. And on the cover, and his subtitle is Covering the Fights for the Soul of the Oregon Coast, and was published in 2003. And he has a quote from Oregon Governor Oswald West on the cover. No local selfish interest should be permitted, through politics or otherwise, to destroy or even impair this great birthright of our people. I don't know where this book is available now. I picked it up many years earlier when it was first published. Matt Love is a very good and enterprising writer, and you find his stuff all over Oregon publications. If you can find a copy of this book, I well recommend it. He has many very good articles about the coast. You've been listening to A Story Told. I'm Michael McCusker.